In the beginning, Ibiza's ancient wells were sacred places of fertility, life and renewal, temples to the moon goddess Tanit. But slowly the people started forgetting, and the more they worshipped the god of the sun, the more the wells began to dry. You're listening to The Wells of Tanit, a podcast celebrating the folklore, mythology, history and ecology of the island of Ibiza. My name is Joanna Ruby. I'm an artist and puppeteer and the founder of Theatre of the Ancients, and we're about to journey together to one of Ibiza's wells to see what stories it has to tell us. Don't be afraid, take my hand, and let's go and find the Wells of Tanit. The sun set about half an hour ago and the sky is blue but pinkish at the bottom, and I'm next to a very old looking bridge. The lights which are illuminating it are now brighter than any other light around here. There's water all around me. There are these huge, big, sprawling, smooth rocks underneath this ancient bridge, and all around them in various directions there are these pools, puddles, little streams of water collecting way behind me in the only remnants of the only river of the Balearic Islands, the Rio de Santa Eularia, Santa Eularia's River. Against this beautiful sky, which is kind of bluey, turning darker and darker, but still the horizon is kind of pale and pinky, and everything around me is gradually becoming silhouetted. The tall grasses, there are some cacti, which look pretty beautiful, illuminated in the lights, which are casting their light onto the old stone arches of the bridge. And in a very dark, shadowy area under the arch of the bridge, which is nearest to me, there is a pool, which is so dark down there that I can almost not see it anymore. But when I first arrived, I could make out very clearly that there was a still, dark pool in there. And that would be the Font de Luna, the Well of the Moon. So I'm on the edge of the town of Santa Eularia, which is the home of the mouth of the only river of the Balearic Islands, which I'm sure I've mentioned in my previous episodes because it's a very, very important place. The only river of Ibiza, and the only river of all of the Balearic Islands. And several decades ago, it dried out completely due to the effects of mass tourism. But here, it really feels like the river is still alive. There are ducks, baby ducks wandering around this evening. You can hear the voices in the distance of local people, just having their evening walk along the lovely walk that goes beside the river, or the remnants of the river. But I've come here to find the Font de Luna, and it's right in front of me. It's that dark shadow under the arch of the ancient bridge, the Pont Vell, which means the old bridge, said to be Roman. And the Font de Luna is what I've come here to find, but there's no way I'm going down there. It's pitch dark, and I have no idea how the locals would have got down there in the days when apparently it was very common for them to come and have a swim in that beautiful, still pool. I'm sure it was a gorgeous place to have a swim. So in the Guía Mágica de Fuentes y Pozos de Santa Eulalia del Río, which translates as the Magical Guide of Springs and Wells of Santa Eulalia, by Michel Ferrer Clapés, the author describes the Fontdenluna as a well which is entangled in many of the ancient traditions related to the nearby Pontevel Bridge, and the setting for all kinds of legends, which predominantly feature familiares, the local pixies, witches, and, quite importantly, the devil. And as I'll explain a little bit more, the Fontdenluna and this bridge are very, very intertwined with Ibiza's ancient summer solstice legends, which, since the arrival of Christianity, Catholicism, has been celebrated here, as in the rest of Spain, on the saint's day of St. John the Baptist, La Noche de San Juan. And this little oasis, I mean, it's a pocket of wildlife and water and beauty, but as you can hear, quite nearby over the new bridge, which is slightly further up the remnants of the river, there are cars that are flowing along into the town of Santa Eulalia, so I'm near but far from the real world. But all of this feels very nicely aligned, because this well is very connected to the solstice, to the Noche of San Juan, which was less than a week ago now. And this feels like quite a special little spot and a special little moment, because this is the 10th episode of my podcast, and in a few weeks I'm celebrating my 40th birthday. I'm a Cancerian, and apparently, according to my mum, who is not in the slightest bit new agey or hippie, the first word that came out of my mouth as a baby was moon. So this feels like the right place to be tonight, recording this episode. And I feel like all sorts of local spirits, witches, and perhaps even the devil himself are celebrating this episode with me. That's nice. So according to the local legends, the devil himself built this bridge, but apparently that's pretty common in the legends around old bridges around the world. And apparently this particular devil built the bridge as part of an agreement with the local mayor of Santa Eulalia. Apparently the mayor and the devil kind of made a sort of a pact with each other, because the mayor needed a bridge, and apparently he offered his soul to the devil in return for the devil building it. But the mayor was very cunning and clever, and he tricked the devil by actually offering a dog instead of himself and hoping that the devil wouldn't notice. But the devil was apparently way too clued up and saw through the mayor's trick, and apparently in order to give your soul to the devil, you had to walk over the bridge once it had been newly constructed. But the devil tricked the mayor by kind of casually walking over the bridge in the direction of the town with him, and from that point onwards, of course, the mayor's soul had been sacrificed to the devil. But this evening, I'm not so interested in the devil, actually. I'm more interested in some other liminal beings which seem connected to this place. Now, there's no firm theories that I've come across to explain why this well beside me or below me is called the Fontdenluna. But I've arrived at my own conclusions from doing a little bit of investigation into the Noche de San Juan, which commonly is associated with fire jumping and kind of solar celebrations. But you only need to start digging beneath the surface of the legends and rituals around the night of San Juan to discover that actually some of it is about the sun, but so much of it is about the moon and about water. It seems to be traditionally a night of communing with freshwater sources, with wells, soaking up a very special energetic charge which is said to be released by the waters on the Midsummer's night. Apparently it's a night for going to the waters and planting wishes and desires. They say that apparently the water drawn soon after midnight on the Noche de San Juan from the local wells, which for the Ibicencos represented the start of a whole new cycle, had a very special significance. In English folklore, they call this the cream of the well. And I read somewhere that, for example, in the country houses of old, a maid would make special efforts to bring their mistress the cream of the well on the night of the solstice. And there's a little quote I came across from one of those maids saying, "My missus always had the cream of the well to wash in on New Year's morning, and she always put a shilling under the basin for me too." And I've even experienced in real time this celebration of fresh water on the morning after San Juan a couple of years ago when I was in Galicia. And the friend that I was staying with, her mother very, very casually said on the morning after San Juan, "Oh, girls, you know, the basin's in the porch. Just, you know, don't forget to wash your hands and faces." And indeed, there was a plastic basin in the porch filled with water, flowers, some herbs gathered from around about. But here on Ibiza, at this very bridge where I'm sat with my recording device, there's a very unique legend associated with the Noche de San Juan. Apparently, only on the night of San Juan, a very special flower grows beneath the arches of this bridge that I'm in front of. It grows for such a brief period of time that it would be very easy to miss it completely. But it is said that if you await the springing up of this particular flower, and if you have a bottle with some well water inside it that has been blessed in the appropriate ways, if you pop the flower into the bottle, close it, you will find on opening it later a familiar, which is a very well-known creature from the depths of Ibizan folklore. It's a kind of a small, hyperactive, troublesome pixie. And this little troublesome pixie will immediately call out the same phrase. It always only says one phrase, which is "feina o menjar," "feina o menjar," which translates from Ibithink as "food or work." So basically, these little pixies wished for two things in life: food or work. And when greeted with a familiar, you had to very, very quickly decide which of those two things you would offer it, because if you didn't answer quickly, it would just kind of go a bit nuts and start destroying everything and eating everything that you had in your house, turning everything upside down. So you would have to, you know, give it lots of tasks that you normally hated doing. But you'd have to be really careful that as soon as the familiar finished the tasks, you had either food or work to give it, because it would just start eating and destroying everything. So in an essay about this well, the Fontenluna, and this bridge, the Pont Vell, the local writer and journalist Cristina Amanda Tour, who I'm also speaking to later in this episode, says that at the bottom of the Fontenluna there is a mirror, and that's not part of any legend. It's fact. She says, "The locals swam here in the days before tourism, and surely the moon reflected in this mirror." And for this episode, as I sit here, I'm wondering whether we could see that mirror, which is now completely plunged in darkness in front of me, as a place where what is real and what is imagined meet. Which is really the theme at the heart of this episode, which is about puppets and dolls and what they stand for and what they can do. So when I first came to Ibiza and I told people that I was a puppeteer, that had a degree in puppetry and I was a puppet maker, they looked at me a bit blankly, because there's never really been any standard puppetry tradition or culture on this island, unlike, for example, in nearby Catalonia, where there are loads of rich puppetry traditions like the giants, the cabezudos. But occasionally people would sort of blurt out, oh yeah, there was a puppeteer here once. She was murdered, didn't you know?" For several years, I kept picking up on these little random sound bites, these snippets of legend around this murdered puppeteer whose killer was never convicted. A German woman called Ingeborg Schäfer. until last year, when the local writer Cristina Amanda Tour published the book Ingeborg, El Crimen de las Marionetas, which translates as Ingeborg, the Puppet Crime, published by the local publishers Balafia Postales. And as I began to read it, I found myself being pulled into that watery mirror, like the one that lies below me, separating facts and fiction, the believable and the unbelievable. And beyond that mirror, I found myself in the arched doorway of a little house in Ibiza's old town in the late 1970s. And through the doorway, a cool, dark entrance hall. And there inside, a small puppet stage, a set of velvet curtains, and behind those curtains, an empty stage. I'm going to share some translated snippets from Cristina's book. And those haunting melodies that you can hear are Satie Blues by Toby Twining, taken from Margaret Leng Tan's album, The Art of the Toy Piano. It's a tip-tapping that lacks melody, but has a certain rhythm. Those long silences interspersed with intense bursts of inspiration. It's the only sound that can be heard in this house. Ingeborg is writing her next story. And as she types, she imagines what kind of musical score she will use. What kind of puppets will best animate the story? How many different voices will be needed, and what kind of sound effects she will have to make. A cat has slipped into the room. There's always some neighbourhood cat creeping around this house. And it seated itself nearby to listen to the steady tap-tap of the typewriter. Ingeborg's hair is scraped back into a bun, and her thin fingers type slowly. She takes a lot of time to consider the words that she is writing. Because, of course, Spanish isn't her native tongue, and her linguistic abilities have their limitations. So in the ground floor of her house in Ibiza's old town, Ingeborg Schaefer started inviting the children of her neighbours and their friends to come to see her puppet plays. The room was filled with wooden benches and had the mystery and silence of a church, until the moment the children came in. Those who didn't fit squeezed onto the floor on cushions. And there before them, the red curtains, and they opened. And as the children left, one puppet was always left leaning against those curtains as though waiting to be revived the next time. These were plays which made the children squeal with delight and also left them frightened. The plays delved into the realm of good and bad. Ogres, princesses, dragons. One audience member recalls, "I especially remember one of the stories in which the hero put on a pair of magic shoes and with their help could overcome any difficulties." All they had to do was run fast and call out, "Run, little shoes, run like the wind." Ingeborg always performed all of the different voices and the sound effects, everything. We were blown away every time. Ingeborg had started performing these plays when her husband, the well-known and well-respected German painter Frank Il Punto, was struggling with illness. She put on these performances to entertain him. But after he died, that was the point when her success really took off. It was as though the very thing that she had used to give a lease of life to her husband ended up bringing to life her own existence. The crime scene. There was blood everywhere. Her head was bashed in. The blood had coagulated and was about two fingers high on the floor. The bedroom was in a mess. There were things thrown on the floor, amongst them a portable typewriter. That machine which, over the course of one night, had transformed from an instrument that made dreams come true into a murder weapon. Ingeborg had been killed with her own typewriter. Christina Amanda Tor's book paints a vivid picture of the times during which Ingeborg lived and performed on Ibiza, and around the time of her death. She and her husband Frank had arrived in the 1950s when, quotes the author, "the large majority of Ibizencos lived exactly how their Phoenician and Carthaginian ancestors had lived, and living on whatever food they grew themselves, also fishing. The islanders got up every day and fulfilled the same tasks that would have been carried out 27 centuries previously. And when they went to bed, they unwittingly ended a day that was very much similar to the ones lived by the first settlers on this island 2,000 years previous." Ibiza in those days was described as an eternal paradise frozen in time. But towards that eternal paradise island, apart from Ingeborg and her husband, many souls with shadowy pasts flocked. And the puppeteer's neighbourhood in Ibiza's old town was dotted with various figures, amongst those former Nazis seeking a refuge in this paradise. Returning to the crime scene. In the kitchen, it was observed that the fridge door had been left open, and beside the hobs there were four cracked eggshells, a plastic bag containing 11 eggs, a half-full bottle of Coca-Cola, a tub of margarine, and a frying pan with leftover scraps of tortilla in it. It seemed whoever had murdered Ingeborg had made a tortilla either before or after committing the act. The night of her murder, Ingeborg had gone to a party of a German friend called Hans Helfritz, who had previously lived a rich life, travelling the world on ethnomusical expeditions and making documentaries. When the Third Reich came into power, he became a key producer of Nazi propaganda for Hitler. A good friend of Ingeborg's, called Jutta, said that around midnight Ingeborg left the party, seeming pallid and nervous. It was normal for her to be nervous whenever she had to drive at night, Jutta said. She didn't like doing it. She always wanted me to drive behind her in my car. Whenever we went out somewhere, she always asked me to accompany her back to the square in the old town where the government building is. And as she got out of her car and walked home, I would always have to wait in my car, sounding the horn every now and again, until I heard her call out from her doorstep that she was safe. Then I could go home. There were several key suspects in the unsolved case of Ingeborg's murder. There was Patricia, an architect who lived nearby with her partner, the Irish writer Edivane Park. Patricia had a bad reputation. She hung out a lot in the nearby legendary Corsario Hotel, where, amongst others, Salvador Dali, Errol Flynn, Onassis, and Orson Welles hung out. She would drink a lot. She was legendary for it. She became loud and verbally aggressive, normally. It was said that she was in love with Ingeborg. The Ibithenko owner of the Corsario Hotel would laugh, chuckle to the other workers there, saying that Patricia was always transfixed by the pretty, dainty figure of Ingeborg every time she walked past. The two other prime suspects were two German brothers, Rolf and Peter, introduced to Ingeborg by her friend Lilo. They would do odd jobs for her, but Ingeborg always said that something about the brothers made her uneasy. When the police searched the brothers' house, amongst other items, they found a folder of writings written by the older brother, Rolf, titled Perverse Documents. These fictitious short stories told of imagined crimes, and amongst them was one which spoke of the delicate dove with the puppets that would await her sacrifice. And in another of Rolf's stories, a victim was killed with a typewriter. Somewhere amongst these pages, there was a reference to the killing of the bird with the golden wings, using the heavy weapon of logic. Fingerprints of the two brothers proved to be inconclusive, and they were eventually released. Their whereabouts since have been unknown. Much of Rolf and Peter's backstory was given to detectives by a friend of Ingeborg's called Lilo, Liselotte Wagner, an artist who lived north in a rambling finca in the hamlet of Balafia, where she had set up some kind of spiritual commune. She had gone out with Rolf for a year and later became entangled with him, trying to help him sort out his life and overcome some financial problems. Several years after Ingeborg's death, Lilo herself died by falling down the well at her finca, her farmhouse in Balafia. It was reported as suicide, but it was never ruled out that she might have been pushed. As Christina Amanda Tor narrates,
Lilo and the well. It could have easily been one of Ingeborg's plays. Only in her version, Lilo never would have jumped and never would have been pushed. Instead, a prince would have gathered her up mid-flight and brought her back to ground level.
So I recently found myself in Calle Santa Maria, outside the doorway of number 8, which several decades ago was known as the Teatro de Muñecas, the puppet theatre. And there I had a very interesting conversation with Cristina Amanda Tor. And the voiceover for this conversation has been provided wonderfully by Bex Fronik.
Bueno, es un domingo por la mañana, el sol está pegando, pero estoy en la sombra con Cristina Amanda Tor.
Well, it's a Sunday morning, the sun is beating down, but I'm in a shady spot with Cristina Amanda Tor, otherwise known as Cat. She's a writer, journalist, and criminologist, and these days her work is largely focused on the ecology, flora and fauna, culture and history of Ibiza. And she has a blog which is at
territoriocat.wordpress.com.
Gracias. Pues encantada de conocerte, Cristina, y
thank you. Well, it's really lovely to meet you, Cristina. And what's it like to be here in this place which relates to such an important product you've been working on in the past couple of years?
Bueno, esta calle evidentemente trae recuerdos, ¿no? Porque es la calle donde...
Yeah, well, obviously this street brings back a lot of memories for me. It's the former residence of Ingeborg, the subject of my latest book.
Y me parece una calle como bastante especial, ¿no?
And I mean, it's quite a special street, right? To me, there's something quite eerie and unsettling about it.
Bueno, porque todas las calles de Dalvila son un poco así, ¿no?
Well, I think that all the streets of Dalvila are a bit like that, right? In any case, this one has definitely changed a lot since that period. In fact, around the time that the crime took place, this street would have been even more spooky because it was partly wooded. Over there, there were pine trees. Now they've cleared it a lot, but yeah, we have these city walls right in front of us.
Sí, es que para mí hay dos cosas. El hecho de que es medio... roca?
Yeah, for me it's two things. It's the fact that facing us is just bare sprawling rock, and this huge towering city wall, there's just harsh stone everywhere. Coupled with the fact that in general this is a street where very few people pass by compared with other streets of the old town where you get a lot more tourists.
Claro, no es una calle céntrica, es una calle un poco de la parte de atrás, ¿no?
Totally. This isn't a main street, it's very tucked away. And with this huge wall going right down it, now in June you get a lot of people passing down this street, but in winter it's really desolate.
En invierno es más solitaria.
Es que no puedo imaginar cómo fue en los años 70 vivir aquí en enero.
I mean, I can't even begin to imagine how it would have been here in the 1970s in January for a widowed woman living on her own.
Claro, debía ser muchísimo más solitario, aunque tenía el bar que tenemos al lado, que ahora es unos apartamentos.
Totally. It would have been even more, much more desolate. Although in those days you did have a bar at the end of the street, El Corsario, which is now apartments. That bar would have brought some life to the area, it has to be said, but yeah, it would have been pretty desolate here and very dark at night.
Sin duda. Y entonces,
for sure. And so, how did you end up focusing your work, your latest book, on the story of this special woman?
De esta mujer tan especial.
La verdad es que, a ver, ya había escrito el primer libro que escribí fue un libro que sacaba.
Well, actually, the first book I wrote was a kind of compilation of various local crimes that have taken place here, and some of them I only dedicated a couple of pages to. With time, I realized that several of those deserved a lot more coverage than I'd given them. This story I had on the back burner for a while because I had to get hold of the court papers from the law courts of Ibiza and, you know, to retrieve court papers from the vaults of the law courts is quite a mission, right? First you have to find out whether they still even exist.
Con lo cual conseguí rescatarlo, se quedó un poco aparcado y un buen día Héctor Escandel, que es director de cine...
Anyway, I had the project on the back burner for a while and one day the film director Héctor Escandel got in touch with me. He was really interested in the subject and wanted to make a documentary about it. So he gave me the push to get hold of the official papers for once and for all. And we started focusing on it because we realized it really needed and deserved to be explored further.
Sí, y además, yo como inglesa, como extranjera...
Yeah, and what's more, for me as an English person, as a foreigner living here, I find it incredible how few of us foreigners know anything about this story. Of all the people I know around me, absolutely no one has ever heard the story of Ingeborg.
Yeah, es que también ten en cuenta que pasó en el 77.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind that this happened in 1977. It was quite a while ago now. So, of course, for the local people, it was huge, a prominent case when it happened, coupled with the fact that the case has never actually been solved, which I suppose makes it more compelling. So, yes, the local people knew all about it, but, well, for the people who arrived here more recently, it's probably normal they don't know of it.
Quizás, pero al mismo tiempo, cuando estudias la historia, lees tu libro...
Yeah, maybe. But when you study the story, when you read your book, to me it's so incredible in so many ways. It really seems like it should be more broadly known by the general international public. And of course, Ingeborg was a foreigner herself.
Aparte era un personaje realmente interesante, o sea, realmente ella...
Yes, and aside from that, she was undoubtedly an extremely interesting individual. She and also her husband, the painter Frank El Punto, they're both individuals whose story should be known. They are part of Ibiza's story. And in fact, all these crimes are part of Ibiza's stories. There are events that only took place here, and the context around them is really important. These things should be known about.
Totalmente. Y también, bueno, yo noto mucho en la Ibiza de hoy.
Totally. And I mean, I notice around me a lot on the island today with all of the spirituality and love and light and harmony that's so talked about here, that something really important is missing. And that's an acknowledgement of the dark side. The darkness of life is a reality.
El reconocimiento de la oscuridad, exactamente, ¿a qué te refieres?
An acknowledgement of the dark side. What exactly do you mean by that?
Lo que quiero decir es sí. que por ejemplo, en tu libro...
What I mean is that, for example, in your book, it's very clearly illustrated that there were some pretty dark things happening on the island around that time. There were people carrying a seriously dark past with them, which they tried to keep undercover.
Y ahora también pasa, evidentemente, y tendría que salir más a la luz, está claro. Sí, sí.
Yeah, and it's still like that now. And now these things should definitely be uncovered and revealed too, for sure.
Porque iba a comentar que la historia y tu libro ilustra los contrastes, como contrastes muy extremas en la isla. Como
I was going to comment that I think your book illustrates so well the extreme contrast present on the island between myth and reality, which is also really evident in the story of the famous art forger and Ibiza resident Elmir Dori. And the writer Clifford Irving, who wrote a completely invented biography here.
Y la inocencia de una mujer haciendo este trabajo tan dulce.
And the contrast between the innocence of Ingeborg, creating these puppet plays which were so sweet and delicate and beautiful, and the fact that she was murdered in a way that was so...
Brutal. Sí. Sí, lo cierto es que esos contrastes hay que conocerlos, ¿no? No...
Brutal, yeah, I mean, I think these contrasts, they have to be revealed and known about. One of the things that most appeals to me about journalism is to bring to light these dark aspects, as you call them. The reality of Ibiza can't be hidden behind a false cardboard facade. Its ugly facets must be revealed too.
Totalmente, porque al mismo tiempo me parece que la cultura popular de Ibiza, pues a mí de hoy, me aburre un poquito.
Totally, because what's more, I think that the mainstream popular culture of Ibiza today is quite boring, and I think that a lot of people are bored with it and have a real thirst to know these other aspects, these other realities of the island. And by the way, you know I'm not talking about traditional local popular culture, of course.
Te entiendo perfectamente. ¿Es ese decorado de cartón piedra, realmente?
No, don't worry. I know exactly what you mean. And yes, it's that false cardboard facade.
O diría plástico.
O plastic facade, maybe.
O plástico, sí. Peor, plástico, sí, sí.
Plastic, yes. Oh, that's worse, yes.
Me ha interesado mucho el hecho de que Ingeborg era titiritera.
What interested me a lot was the fact that Ingeborg, as a puppeteer, because I'm also a puppeteer, and I'll touch on that a little bit more in a second, but basically, the puppeteer always takes a back seat in their work. They always stand in the shadows behind the protagonists, which are the puppets.
Y lo que noto mucho en esta historia, que me ha fascinado leer tu libro, es que al final...
And what fascinates me in this story and in your book is the fact that, in the end, the story of Ingeborg is almost more about her puppets and the strange, dodgy and colourful characters that surrounded her in Dalt Villa at that time than it is about her.
Mm-hmm. Si es que realmente cuando empezamos a tirar del hilo...
Yep. The truth is that the moment you start following the breadcrumbs on a story like this, every step of the way you uncover yet another fascinating character. And as you get to the point where you think, this case is never ending, the most interesting characters just keep on revealing themselves, shady ones and not so shady ones. And each time, you want to keep learning about these rich characters.
Y Héctor lo dijo en algún momento, dice que cada uno de los personajes tendría un libro por sí solo.
At one point, Hector said to me, every single one of these people deserves their own book, a book to be written about them. So in the end, this case becomes kind of a web of interlinking stories. I don't for one moment wish that Ingeborg herself becomes overlooked, because in the end, everything centers around her. But it's definitely true that, wow, the figures who surrounded her provided very rich material indeed.
Me ha gustado mucho como conocer a ese red.
Yeah, for me it was so fascinating to learn about that incredibly complex web of people, relationships, acquaintances, places. It was so interesting. Also, it interests me that Ingeborg seemed to believe very strongly in values and concepts that were very morally sound, almost angelic and celestial. But what struck me was the fact that she was really afraid of walking alone in the streets of Dalt Villa at night.
Sí, es que realmente yo creo que era una mujer asustadiza que además estaba rodeada de demonios.
Yes, I think the truth is that she was a very anxious and frightened woman. And what's more, she was surrounded by demonic people. She wasn't stupid, she knew this. The people in her circles, well, let's say some of them weren't very Snow White, and she was aware of this. So we're talking about a very frightened woman, but a good-hearted woman. And yeah, she was surrounded by demons.
¿Hay algún demonio en particular que... ¿Te acuerdas de la historia que te ha...?
Is there any individual in particular that you think of as being one of those demons?
Bueno, yo realmente lo que es más significativo es cómo había ese sector nazi.
Well, I think what's most significant in general terms is the Nazi connections that were evident in her social circle. Some of her friends were ex-Nazis, her husband had Nazi links, and to be clear, I'm not saying that any of those people would have necessarily presented any kind of threat or danger to her, or to anyone. But neither her nor anyone else would have been able to be blind to those basic facts. It's a presence that couldn't be ignored.
Que no se le puede olvidar a nadie.
Y te hace ver que, por lo menos en esta época, esas como sectas.
And it's fascinating because it makes you realize that these different social sects were living so close and interwoven with each other.
Sí, sí, pero en círculos separados, porque realmente esta gente no se juntaba con los ibicencos.
Yes, completely. But in separate circles, because in reality they didn't really mix with the Ibicencos. The Germans that hang out at El Corsario up the road, they generally just hung out with other Germans.
¿Hay algún aspecto particular de la historia de Ingeborg que ilustra cómo era la época de esa época de Ibiza comparado con ahora, por ejemplo?
Is there any particular aspects of Ingeborg's story that you feel illustrates something important about how the island was in those days compared with how it is now?
Bueno, hay algunos aspectos que me han resultado muy interesantes y es que claro, estamos hablando de una época.
Well, yes. There are a couple of aspects which have been particularly interesting to me. I mean, the time when a lot of these characters first arrived on the island, there was no airport, which I think is quite significant. They would have all arrived by boat. So the recollections and accounts that we have from some of those people of how they first sailed to the island, into the main port, I think it's very interesting.
Me parece que da una visión de Ibiza que aunque en ese momento tenía esa parte oscura también, porque todos los lugares tienen una parte oscura siempre.
Those accounts paint a fairly utopia-like vision of the island, different in so many ways to the one we know today. I mean, we know that the island has its dark side, like all places do, but it was very different to the dark side of the island that we see around us today.
En el libro maravilloso de Juan Luis Ferrer, Ibiza, la destrucción del paraíso.
In Juan Luis Ferrer's wonderful book, Ibiza, la destrucción del paraíso, or Ibiza, the destruction of paradise, he talks about how the island's golden age, if there ever was one, was more or less around the period that we're talking about, the late 70s, when he says that the struggles and the hardships of the previous centuries were kind of way back in the past, but the new problems of mass tourism and globalization were still virtually non-existent. And maybe that's the picture that the book paints for me. The fact that during this time there was some kind of special harmony here. The foreigners were generally much, much more integrated with the local culture.
Es que además, claro, desde entonces hasta ahora.
The thing is that since that point, just as Juan Luis points out in his book, the changes come so rapidly and in such a brutal way that it's as though neither the island nor the Ibicenco people had time to adapt to them. It's all come too fast. I think that this period around Ingeborg's death was a real turning point for the island, because just as I said, the airport had just opened, and from then mass tourism arrived, and everything changed.
Antes la gente que venía aquí, pues tenían que hacer un esfuerzo.
Before, I guess that the people who arrived had to really make a damn effort to get here.
Sí, y debía serlo, ¿eh?
Yes. And that's how it should be, I think.
Otro aspecto del libro que me parecía interesante es cómo ilustra la mezcla de creencias religiosas y espirituales.
Another aspect of the book that I found really interesting is how it illustrates the mix of spiritual and religious beliefs that were floating around the island at that time in those little social bubbles. The theory that Ingeborg and her husband, Frank El Punto, were part of some kind of Christian Science sect?
Bueno, la verdad es que investigando esa parte no ha podido quedar muy claro.
Well, the truth is that I struggled to get to the bottom of Ingeborg's precise spiritual beliefs. In the end, we came to the conclusion that regardless of your spiritual or religious standing, people can always have their conflicts and disagreements with their chosen belief system. So she wasn't necessarily devoutly following her particular spiritual practice. One thing that we never knew for sure, but we did suspect it might be true, based on the accounts of others, was that Ingeborg was engaged in spiritualism to try and communicate with her deceased husband.
Y la amiga de Ingeborg, Lilo, que vivía en Valacia, su casa era como una comuna espiritual o un ashram o algo así.
And Ingeborg's friend Lilo, who lived in Balafia, her house was some kind of spiritual commune or ashram, right?
Tipo ashram, lo que pasa es que se le vio escapar de las manos. Yo he conseguido hablar pues con gente que la conocía, de hecho unos ibicencos que...
Yeah, I think it was a kind of ashram. The thing is that it apparently got out of hand. I've managed to speak to some of the people who knew Lilo, ibicencos actually, a guy whose parents knew her when he was small, and they said that there were problems at the house. The place was run like a kind of hippie commune, and well, you can imagine. There were people hanging around there who weren't really up to much good, who took advantage of the place and her, and things went a bit sour.
Me ha encantado en algún punto del libro dices que básicamente el libro no da ninguna conclusión concreta.
So returning to the general themes of the book, at some point you say that basically the book doesn't attempt to offer any firm conclusions. Rather, it's a kind of a making of, I think you call it. And that's what I really, really get from the book. It's a collection of possibilities, of anecdotes, of such diverse threads that seem to connect around the axis of Ingeborg. I value that a lot because, well, we all know that these days things can be pretty black and white, and it's nice to look at a subject and not seek any concrete answers about it.
Además, tú piensas, claro, no es mi trabajo tampoco.
Totally. It's not my place to really give my verdict on the case. I mean, it wouldn't be fair. Imagine if I'd written that my conclusion was that Patricia, Ingeborg's friend, had murdered her. I mean, she was one of the main suspects. What I've done is tried to paint a picture of her, both her favourable and her not-so-favourable aspects, always making it clear that so much of the information that we have is based on opinions. We can't deny the fact that there are details that would suggest that she'd done it for sure, but coincidences happen. All I can do is share the documentations, the accounts that we have available, and that's it. Let's let the judgment happen when they get to heaven.
Lo que hemos encontrado, y ahí ya... Mm-hmm. Que el cielo los juzgue, ¿no?
Y es evidente que los dos sospechosos, pues ninguno de ellos han vivido una vida feliz y larga después de lo que pasó en esa época, porque Patricia murió de una enfermedad.
Sí.
Los hermanos, pues, duro mucho.
And I mean, I think it's pretty clear that none of the three prime suspects have gone on to lead a particularly fulfilling or happy life after what happened to Ingeborg. Patricia died of an illness in the years afterwards. The two German brothers, well, based on what you wrote about in the book, I very much doubt that they went on to live very successful or happy lives back in Germany or wherever it was that they went off to afterwards.
No, hombre, Patricia, no recuerdo a qué edad murió, pero yo creo que Patricia, tanto si lo fue como si no lo fue realmente, quedó bastante marcada por esto.
No. I don't remember how old Patricia was when she died, but whether she was guilty of murder or not, Her life was very much tainted by the event, because imagine, after Ingeborg's death, many of her friends pointed their fingers at Patricia as the murderer. Imagine if all along she was innocent, and all that time she's been accused and suspected. I mean, in the end, she moved out of Doubt Villa. She ended her relationship with the writer, Edwin Park, probably as a result of what happened. What is clear is that life wasn't easy for her after the murder.
Es chocante que no se podía llegar a ninguna conclusión.
It really is quite amazing that no firm conclusion was ever arrived at. But I guess, as you say in the book, it had to do with the investigative methods that were available at the time. But it's really surprising.
Claro, pero es que siempre hay que pensar cuando además lees un libro así. Siempre hay, además yo lo recuerdo constantemente porque creo...
I think whenever you read a book like this, you simply have to place yourself in that time period. It's important that people really have a sense of what things were like in those days. I mean, this was 1977.
No existían las pruebas de ADN, la policía estaba con unos recursos, bueno, nunca tiene los recursos adecuados, pero entonces tampoco...
DNA testing didn't exist, and the police had very limited resources. I mean, even more limited than now. The individuals on Ibiza who investigated the case were not particularly specialists in their field. I'm not saying that none of them were any good, but it's all a domino effect. The judges weren't that particularly amazing, and I mean, when you're working on a case, there are so many influencing factors. The human factor, the resources available.
Me gusta que en el libro hablas de que dentro de la historia de Ingeborg hay como el cumplimiento de varios círculos.
Another thing I'd really like to touch on from your book is that you mentioned that within the story of Ingeborg, there's the completion of all of these little mini narrative cycles, almost like mini stories. And I wanted to share with you that something that I read in your book completed one of those little cycles in my own life, which has to do with Ingeborg's friend Lilo in Balafia.
Porque yo soy titiritera y vivo en Daltvila. Uh-huh. Pero tengo mi taller en Balafia.
Because, as I said, I'm a puppeteer, I work with puppets, and I live in Doubt Villa. But my workshop is in Balafia. That's where I keep all my puppets, my work, everything. And for the last 5 years, I've had a space in that workshop, which is on a piece of land belonging to an Ibicenco couple. And the fact that we've managed to keep that space for the past 5 years, paying a pretty reasonable monthly rent, and that the landlady has supported us, cared for us all of that time, even though it seems like her family is not really interested in keeping us there, I've got my own theory about why that is.
La teoría que tengo es porque ella, una vez hace muchos años, nos contó que cuando ella era niña...
A couple of years ago, I remember her saying that when she was a young girl, there was only one foreigner in the tiny hamlet of Balafia where she lived, and it was a German artist who kind of took her under her wing and obviously inspired her a lot. And so many years later, when a bunch of foreign artists approach her to rent her space, from the very beginning, it seemed like she really, really wanted to have us there to kind of protect us and defend us, despite her husband and sons really not wanting us to be there. So my feeling is that all of this has got to do with the friendship that she had as a child with Lilo.
Yeah, Lilo es otro personaje interesante porque además ahí sigue, así que ahí sí hay un misterio.
Yeah, Lilo is another interesting character altogether because also there's still a real mystery there. We still don't know about her death, whether it was a suicide or not, or if she was thrown into the well. It's not clear at all. It's another case which I believe wasn't investigated as thoroughly as it should have been.
No. Y morir de esa manera.
No. And to die in that particular way, although you point out in the book that jumping into a well was a fairly common method of suicide here in past times.
Sí, suicidarse tirándose al pozo no era raro, vamos.
Yep, committing suicide by throwing yourself down a well was. Well, it wasn't so out of the ordinary, let's say. I'm not saying it happened every day, but it wasn't that unheard of. But yeah, in this case, we have to question whether it was actually suicide or whether someone pushed her. You know, there were people around her in the commune who perhaps had problems and who weren't on good terms with her.
En la comuna.
Y se podría suponer que quizás habían uso de drogas también. Claro. No se sabe qué estaba pasando
claro.
en esa casa.
I guess it's also likely that there was drug use going on there at the house at that time. Who knows what was going on in there?
Claro, imagínate. O sea, es que montar una casa de este estilo, que además quieres hacer conferencias de espiritualidad y cosas así, todo eso.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the house was set up as a kind of place for conferences, spiritual talks and things like that. I mean, a place like that always attracts people who are looking to take whatever they can get, to hang on and take advantage. And let's be clear, that still happens today.
¿Qué representa la historia de Ingeborg para ti?
So, what does Ingeborg's story represent for you? I mean, this exceptional story about a pretty exceptional individual, a puppeteer who lived in Dalt Villa in such a strange, desolate back street as this one, and who ended up being murdered. Does this story make you reflect in any way on the island, on...
Claro, yo he aprendido mucho haciendo este libro, porque claro, hablo de una isla que yo... tampoco conocía realmente.
Oh, yes, totally. I mean, I've learned a lot writing this book because it deals with a side of the island that was previously alien to me. And let's face it, this is stuff that you will never read about in a tourist guide. From carrying out my investigations, I've uncovered these intimate stories of the people living here in that era. The foreigners who came and went, the Ibisencos, I've learned so much about an Ibiza that I never previously knew.
¿Y qué crees que esta historia transmite?
And what do you think the book is capable of transmitting to people who don't know the island so well? Is there anything in particular that you feel this story demonstrates or a message that it carries?
Yo quiero que el mensaje sea que Ibiza no es ningún sitio especial.
What I want the book to transmit is the fact that there's nothing special about Ibiza. It has its darker aspects, its less dark aspects, as we talked about earlier, but it's not a special place, it's not a magical place. It has all the problems that you'd find anywhere else in the world. In fact, it maybe has more problems. And basically, I think that there are several myths about Ibiza that this book tries to deconstruct. One of them is that tourism has saved us. Another is that here, everything is rose-tinted. What I really try to do in the book, what I'm trying to do in my more recent work, is to lay to rest certain myths, to dismantle false cardboard facades.
Como yo trabajo con cartón piedra, me parece, me adoro ese metáforo que estás usando.
As someone who works with cardboard, I simply adore the metaphor that you're using. And I think it's really interesting that in the end, Ingeborg worked with myths, worked with fairy tales, she crafted these stories. But what you're saying is that the story of her life is actually the deconstruction of various myths. I find that so interesting.
Sí. Además es que uno de los problemas que tuve al empezar esta historia, de hecho yo creo que es uno de los problemas que había.
Yes. What's more, one of the big problems that I had working on this case, and in fact it's one of the main reasons why I delayed starting on the project for so long until Hector started pressuring me, is the extent of these fabricated myths surrounding the story. You come across people who hardly know anything about the case, but somewhere they read a few lines and now they're convinced that the Nazis murdered Ingeborg, that there was some kind of strange ritual conducted around her murder.
Documental en el que hablan de que las marionetas rodeaban el cadáver y cosas así.
There's a documentary out there that claims that when Ingeborg's body was found, it was surrounded by her puppets and things like that. And it's all completely untrue. But you know, when something is repeated a dozen times, or it's talked about in a documentary, people tend to start believing it. In that way, a legend is created. And so, yeah, when I started working on this story, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have to start by deconstructing all of these invented stories. I had the court papers in my own hands. If Ingeborg's corpse had been surrounded by puppets when it was discovered, that would obviously have featured in the papers.
Vale, de hecho, cuando hicieron el documental, yo les dije, no es verdad, en el sumario no consta esto.
When the documentary came out, I had to literally tell them, this never happened. It's completely untrue. But they still kept it in the documentary because, well, a legend is a legend, and you should never let the truth get in the way of a good story, right? So, you know, I was daunted by the amount of false information that I would have to sift through and sort out. And you can't eradicate all of it because, who knows, maybe some of the information deemed accurate is completely wrong. It's really difficult. In the end, I'm sure some of the details in the book are not 100% accurate because, or so much of it is opinion based.
Y al final lo único que puedes hacer es como un reportaje sobre las fantasías de todas esas personas.
In the end, maybe all that you can do is record and collect the various fantasies of all of these individuals. And what you end up with is a story that is truly fascinating for everyone.
Claro, espero que quede claro lo que es fantasía, lo que yo veo que es fantasía, porque realmente no tenemos datos para pensar que es otra cosa.
All that I hope is that the line between what is fantasy, because we have no evidence to prove that it is otherwise, and what is real, is clearly defined.
Aunque supongo que la realidad de la historia de Ibiza es que mucha gente de fuera han venido aquí con ideas.
Although I guess that a reality about this island is that many foreigners from other lands have come here with false, deluded ideas, with slightly unhinged fantasies, and I guess that in a way you can treat that as a plain fact.
Eso sí es verdad, sí, totalmente.
Yes, that's true. I think it's done the Ibizencos quite a lot of damage, because of course if people come here with a particular idea of how the island is or how we are, that puts a lot of pressure on us, which we still have to bear now. People continue to come to this island with a distorted idea of what Ibiza is, and it's important to me to demonstrate that this idea is false.
Lo único que añadiría a eso es que aunque tu libro como desmonta esas fantasías.
The only thing that I'd add to that is the fact that although your book deconstructs so many of these fantasies and demonstrates that Ibiza is just like any other place, I wish to repeat one more time that this story is so crazy and so unbelievable, despite you having removed all of the delusions and false theories.
Sí, lo he intentado al menos, pero aparece. Claro, no, hombre, hablo de la fantasía también, aunque sea para desmontarla.
Yeah, at least you can definitely say I've tried. But the fantasy probably creeps in there no matter how hard you try to sniff it out. In any case, I'm thrilled that you got something from it.
No, me ha impactado mucho. Y como dije, como titiritera, y con esos vínculos...
No, like I said, the book and the story have had a really big impact on me. As a puppeteer, and with those distant connections that I discovered I had with one of the key figures of the story, it's been really interesting. And do you know anything about the current inhabitants of the house? This house right behind us, where Ingeborg lived, where she performed her plays, and where she was murdered? And whether the current inhabitants know about what took place here?
Sí, 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 lo saben. Hablamos con uno, bueno, hablamos con un amigo suyo que nos dio el teléfono.
Yeah. Yes, they know. I talked to a friend of theirs who spoke on their behalf because they didn't want to talk. They're foreigners. They only come and stay in the house occasionally. But yes, they know perfectly well what happened in their house.
Y un último comentario. ¿Qué quieres que la gente se acuerde de Ingeborg hoy en día?
And one final little question. How do you think Ingeborg should be remembered today?
Ostras, no sé. Yo creo que vale la pena recordar quién fue, lo que hizo.
Let's see. I think it's important to remember who she was, what she did. I think it's important to remember her as being an individual who came to Ibiza from afar and truly loved the island, cared for it, respected it, which is very important and not always the case with the people that come here. And, well, both Ingeborg and her husband, despite his shady aspects, were people who I believe came to Ibiza to truly value it.
Sí, estoy totalmente de acuerdo.
Yeah, I agree completely. What I've read is that she was extremely highly regarded. The quality of her work as an artist and performer, the humble way in which she lived her life, the way that she dealt with the people around her as a person. Sounds like she was a really fine example of a human being. And of an Ibiza expat, and an artist and puppeteer.
Por lo que te toca también, ¿no?
In all the important aspects, yes.
Bueno, muchísimas gracias, Cristina. Ha sido súper interesante.
Well, thank you so much, Cristina. This has been really interesting.
So, it's even darker here now. For some reason, the cars have got louder, or they sound louder now that everything else has got darker and perhaps quieter. The crickets have got louder as well. And the only illumination really is the lights on shining onto the arches of the bridge. Some lights illuminating the path that I need to get back onto to get home. And some distant street lights. Also the little light illuminating the church on top of the hill next to me. So we're back beside that dark mirror of the Fonte della Luna, which is now cast in complete blackness. And honestly, I never would have imagined that the subject of this episode would end up touching on this theme, this reoccurring theme of what is real and what is fantasy, between the difference between the myth and the deconstructed myth, between cardboard and flesh and bone. Maybe this island is full of foreigners flocking here like moths to a flame, looking for something that was never even here in the first place. It seems like in the end, Ingeborg was killed by the fantasies of somebody else. Maybe Ingeborg as a puppeteer was the only person who knew how to separate fantasy and reality, to know what was a puppet or a doll and what wasn't. Seems like she was surrounded by this murky swamp of delusions and deluded people. This place where right and wrong, good and bad, were all mushed up and muddled. It seems like Ingeborg's world of princesses, toads, fairies, dragons was her way of trying to unmuddle that crazy world that she lived in, finding characters that she could maybe trust and rely on. And I guess in a similar way, all of the generations of Ibithenkos who shaped this myth of the familiar, which was born so close to where I'm sitting, they just wanted to invent a character that could do the impossible, that could carry out the tasks that they all hated. So other than those pixies buried deep in local island folklore and the crafted puppets which brought to life Ingeborg's fairy tales and the giant cardboard creatures made by English women here, I wonder who else in Ibiza's past and present have engaged in this strange practice of fabricating an imaginary being whose image and identity fulfills some kind of purpose that is of use to the maker or to the imaginer. Well, on reflection, I think the earliest example of people doing this here probably centres around a particular miniature doll fashioned out of clay, the likes of which several hundred were found in a small cave in the northeast of the island in the early 1900s. That cave turning out to be one of the most important goddess cave sanctuaries in the Mediterranean, dating back several millennia. In her essay, A Brief History of San Vicente, by historian Emily Kaufman, which features in the novel The Road to San Vicente, the writer tells us that before Escuyeram was officially excavated by local archaeologists in 1907, much mystery was attached to the cave, and locals often pottered about inside. Children especially were fond of going to the cave to look for dolls, which of course were the figurines of the goddesses that had been used as votive offerings, many of which still remained intact. What were these clay effigies representing the goddess Tanit, if not puppets? Fantasy dolls created to fulfill a specific duty that was lacking in the daily reality of the first Phoenician settlers of the island. A being that would ensure that rains would still fall, that the sun would always shine, that crops would not fail, that wells and springs would not go dry, and stomachs would not go hungry. In the end, Kaufman suggests that the people at that time lost faith in the qualities that those sculpted little dolls represented. She tells of evidence that Tanit's cave fell out of use during a time of great hunger and crop failure on the island, and it appears to some that the cave was either set alight accidentally or was purposefully engulfed in flames with those dolls inside it. And finally, I reflect on the possibility that over two millennia later, maybe nothing has changed around here. It seems that fantasy dolls in the year 2022 are still being fashioned to transmit qualities and values that would otherwise be lacking in normal reality. And the example I'm going to share with you is from a few days ago in a local, quite legendary Facebook group. A very controversial post gained around 200 comments and gained so much attention and controversy that it even made it into the local press. And the original post reads as follows. I'm being asked to DJ at more and more VIP and celebrity villa parties this summer, and the organisers are asking me to invite stunning image models, paying minimum €300 cash plus taxi fare in and out, usually minimum 6 hours, obviously free food and drink as you want. If interested, message me with your photo and the usual details, age, height, nationality. Now, this post went a bit crazy. And to be honest, the comments were made for quite an entertaining read. Some of the responses to this message were the simple, good grief. Another one was, cool, I'd also pay for hot girls to be around me if I had no personality or any real friends. Another one read, tell me you're a pimp without actually saying it. Sounds toxic and predatory. And finally, and not the only one, there were comments in defence of the original post, such as, just so you all know, he was so nice and down to earth, and not once did he make any sleazy remark or make me feel like I would be expected to sleep with the clients. And any party I go to, I can honestly say I would feel totally safe with the person in question around. The job is exactly as it was described and nothing more. So before people start debating, please be sure to know what you're talking about, because it's not fair to drag somebody's name through the mud because you presumed he's pimping girls out. Also, getting offended for saying pretty girls, I'm sorry, but unfortunately all jobs have specific requirements, and the requirements would be exactly the same if I wanted to be a model for Tommy Hilfiger, who would also not allow unattractive women on his catwalk. It's life, and it's true, so no point moaning, just concentrate on being happy and living your best life. So there you have it. Nighttime at the Font de Luna, darkness settling all around me, and there is no way that I can see that mirror anymore. It's cast in a huge shadow, but I still love the idea of that portal that separates fact and fiction. And my visit here has led me to some really surprising conclusions. It turns out that we've been fashioning puppets and dolls on this island for two solid millennia. Perhaps once upon a time, those dolls were made to promise fertility, successful crops, ecological protection. Perhaps later in the island's history, those dolls were crafted by a woman who was just seeking the reassurance of a clear moral and ethical code to believe in. And perhaps even later, those dolls were fashioned to exude sex appeal, perceived success and popularity. And yeah, over several centuries, those dolls were crafted or imagined to give people the idea that maybe there's a little creature around that could do all of the jobs around the house that you just don't want to do. So anyway, if from ancient history to modern times, all of this has never changed, and if we're all still looking for these particular things which change with the centuries, but really are all part of the same quest, then I guess I can only give you one recommendation. To perhaps wait until next midsummer, just past midnight, and find your way to the caramel-coloured Roman bridge with the arches at the mouth of the Santa Eulalia River, and bring your wish to that strange, dark mirror of the Font de Luna, which is all at once a bathing pool, a mirror, and a doorway towards your heart's desires. You've been listening to The Wells of Tanit, created by me, Joanna Ruby. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please help to spread the word and leave us a review on iTunes, as this really helps the podcast reach more listeners. You can support this podcast and enter more deeply into my creative work in relation to the myths, culture and folklore of Ibiza by joining the Theatre of the Ancients online Patreon community. Go to www.patreon.com/Theatre of the Ancients and you'll find this link in the text accompanying the podcast. Sincere thanks to Toby Twining for allowing me to feature his toy piano arrangement of John Lennon and Paul McCartney's Eleanor Rigby in this episode, which was performed by Margaret Leng Tan. The theme music is the song De Joet Vas Despedient by the Ibizan folk group Uk, released by Productions Blau.
Que dins mon cor repeteix lo que em deies aquell dia. Sempre t'apreciaré i on s'afulla que sigues només per dar-te entenent que de tu estic agraït.